This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
This week, what happens when universities are looking for more funding?
You then develop in some universities, it varies from place to place, a kind of commercialized atmosphere where people are looking to the marketplace rather than to their duties as teachers and researchers.
Coming up, author Dan Greenberg lays out the arguments of his latest book, Science for Sale. Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and you're listening to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. First up, in news, salmonella in space become deadlier, Congress gets concerned about biosafety, and researchers develop hair cells on demand. Ala Katznelson has more.
In a report in the September 25th issue of PNAS, researchers say spaceflight makes salmonella more virulent. Researchers from Arizona State University blasted the bacterium into space aboard the shuttle Atlantis and found altered gene expression. Notably, they found reduced expression of the regulatory protein HFQ, which is thought to respond to stress and alter virulence in space. The samples also showed increased biofilm formation, which could affect virulence because bacteria aggregated in biofilms are less susceptible to host defense mechanisms. Laura Frost of the University of Alberta in Canada told The Scientist that, quote, "The interesting thing about this experiment is that low gravity appears to be a stress that the bacteria can detect." Also in news, universities are tightening oversight over research into potentially dangerous biologic agents as Congress prepares to conduct a hearing into bioterror research programs. Problems at university labs in Texas and Wisconsin have raised concerns that research designed to protect the public's health may actually increase the possibility of exposure to harmful biological agents. Last week, following an NIH inquiry into 13 laboratory incidents at the University of Texas at Austin, the university announced it would ramp up training and establish a rapid response team. At the University of Wisconsin, researchers made and manipulated copies of the Ebola virus genome in a level 3 lab when work should have been done at safety level 4. The project has since moved to a lab in Canada. Congress meets for its hearing October 4th. In research news, hearing scientists at the University of Virginia School of Medicine have developed a culture system to produce large quantities of hair cells. Currently, hearing researchers have to get their hair cells from the inner ear directly from an animal, and even then they only end up with a few hundred cells. The culture came from the inner ear of chicken embryo, and birds are known to be able to regenerate hair cells. The culture could help identify what is responsible for that regenerative ability, and also allow researchers enough material to isolate unknown proteins involved in sensory transduction. The technique appears in the September 25th issue of PNAS.
That was The Scientist, Ala Katznelson. You can read more from The Scientist Daily News on our website, thescientist.com. Next, we turn to capitalism on campus. Journalist Dan Greenberg's latest book explores the relationship between university administrators, academic scientists, and industry. I spoke with Greenberg recently. Here's what he had to say about the problems in funding academic science.
Universities are always ravenous for money, they outrun the amount of money that's available from the federal government for research. And research is one of the prime important prestige activities at the big universities. So they look around for other sources of money, and one is the activities going on in their own laboratories. Of course, industry is often interested in buying results that can be commercialized. And you then develop in some universities, it varies from place to place, a kind of commercialized atmosphere where people are looking to the marketplace rather than to their duties as teachers and researchers. And this can introduce a lot of unwelcome qualities into the research community, such as secrecy, for example, to protect commercially potential research. The collegiality that at least mythology says once existed in university among university researchers gets seriously eroded when people have one eye on the marketplace and the other on their research. So those are some of the problems.
In the beginning, in the first chapter, there's a statement there that caught my eye, and it says, "To maintain the fiction of a government-university financial partnership in research, Washington, the main source of money for academic research, pays only part of the claimed indirect costs, leaving the balance to the university as its share of the tab. There's a lot in that sentence, but the word fiction really struck me. What do you mean by that?
It's kind of difficult to describe briefly, but the federal government says that universities must share in the costs of the research that is financed for which the federal government provides money. And the way they share in the cost is that the indirect costs that are generated by research, such as library services, security, you know, heat and electricity, depreciation, and things like that sort, are not fully reimbursed by the federal government. So the universities have to pay for part of that. Now, there's a tremendous amount of argument about whether or not the universities are ripping off the federal government or whether the federal government is ripping off the universities when it comes to indirect costs. Some people say that the indirect costs are pure gravy for universities. Others say, no, these are genuine costs, and they are part of the price of doing research, and the government should pay for it. So we have a big fight going on about it. But there is a kind of fiction that the two parts, the universities and the federal government, are partners in this. The universities will say, well, we're getting kind of a bad deal, but it's the best we can get. And the government says, you know, you're doing pretty well by us, and stop complaining.
At the end of your book, you have some recommendations on how to fix this problem and the friction between academia and industry.
Yeah. Well, I think as far as recommendations go, I have to lean on that old reliable transparency. And that means that if faculty members, scientists at a university, have outside commercial dealings, this should not be sub rosa. The information about what they're doing, for whom, and how much they're getting paid, I think should be in a campus database accessible to all. And I think the advantage of doing that is you're not going to have a situation in which somebody is on the quiet working for a pharmaceutical company while wearing the hat of a university professor. And who knows what he's doing about the amount of time devoted to university business versus the amount of time devoted to pharmaceutical business, whether it's graduate students are being put to work on pharmaceutical business. I think that, you know, all of these things should be simply out in the open. I think universities, people in universities, are generally inclined to do the honorable thing, to regard the university as an important institution whose reputation and integrity have to be protected. And I think transparency contributes greatly to that. Another point that I think is of considerable importance is that medical schools, and some of them are doing this, should keep pharmaceutical representatives off the premises. They're not there to provide education, as they claim. They say they're there to tell students and the faculty about new drugs that are on the market or are coming to the market. They're there for marketing purposes. And they really have no place in the halls of medical education, because they are giving the students and the faculty a distorted view. That is the view of their company, rather than something that's, you know, right down the middle and giving them a straight pharmaceutical lecture. Rather, they're selling in the guise of being the friendly guy who brings pizzas for lunch and then casually chats about new drugs that are coming to the market from their company. So I think those are some of the things, and they're very important things, that universities can do to protect their integrity.
That was author Dan Greenberg discussing his upcoming book, Science for Sale: The Perils, Rewards, and Delusions of Campus Capitalism. The University of Chicago Press releases the book in October. If you've got your own thoughts on the subject, drop us a note at thescientist.com. There you can also find blogs from our editors, daily news stories, and the latest articles from The Scientist magazine. That's all for our podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.